Your name?
Shirley Kressel.
As we attend this National Conference for Media Reform, there was a very interesting forum this morning. Big news in Boston. The state of Boston media, there were a number of local journalists. You had a very interesting question to ask of the panelists in the Q&A. I wonder if you could repeat that question now and talk about the answers you did receive and what you didn't get from the panelists.
Well, in brief, I was asking if the media are politically intimidated by local powerful politicians. And there is one. There's only one such. And that's the mayor of Boston. He is really omnipotent and imperial. And I know that I've experienced these situations where I write pieces about him and find that they're printed with his name edited out. And it becomes a story about something else altogether. So I know this is going on because people don't want to lose access to him and to everybody that he influences when they want to get information for a story. It makes it harder for me when I do my investigative research because nobody will talk to me and I have to go and do it the hard way and get, you know, documents and pull hen's teeth and find out what I need to know. But at least that's the truth. I mean, if you just get interviews with these politicians, basically you're channeling propaganda, and that's what a lot of the writers end up doing. So I found that they were pretty much denying that was the case. I mean, that's not something anybody would admit. And it's true that there are stories, as the Globe person said, that are exposés, but they're mostly on the state level. They're not things that actually name the mayor as an implicated party. And everybody knows that very few decisions are made in Boston without him. So I have to conclude that there's some level of self-censorship, you know, protective self-censorship in the media that relate to that. The person from WBUR is not the manager of that channel that I dealt with before. But in the last gubernatorial election, I was supporting the Green Party. The Green Party had a gubernatorial candidate. And the other media had actually set up barriers not to allow that candidate into the debates, like she didn't collect enough campaign donations. I mean, that should be a badge of honor. Yeah, the other ones have all sold out, and those are the ones we want to have at our debate table. So this candidate, Jill Stein from the Green Party, well, she doesn't get big campaign contributions because developers and businesses aren't interested in supporting her because they know they'll never buy her. So one of the stations in this media consortium that was blocking her out was WBUR, which was astounding to me because, you know, if you can't count on WBUR, then, you know, where is the most democratic outlet?
Is it the NPR station?
Yeah, right, the NPR station. And I ended up actually on that station for some interview about something else, privatization of the public space, which is actually my real interest, privatization of parks and so on. And I asked him, how could he join a consortium that blocks out a third-party candidate? I mean, a credible, real third-party candidate. And he said, oh, you know, she doesn't have a chance. And anyway, she's only talking about, you know, all this corruption and tax breaks and stuff. Enough of that. And I thought, well, will you lock somebody out of the debates because you decided they don't have a chance? So I gave him a little back talk, which was kind of interesting because I was there as his guest to be interviewed on one of his shows as a foil for a city councilor. And they both looked at each other like, well, this is why we have Shirley around, I guess, you know.
Was this live on the air?
My argument but with back, him wasn't, no. But the interview was going to be.
Yeah.
No, this was just sort of, you know, green room banter. And I was saying, what? You that's why you blocked out a third party? How is anybody supposed to break in and give some competition to these other two, which are basically the same? In this particular case, they actually were almost identical, the governor's race. And he was very flippant about it. So I think that there's a lot of... you should look at some of the boards of these, even the NPR stations. You know, they're pretty mainstream people. There are some big corporate presences on those boards. So I and also, it's a Boston University. Remember they were saying that Northeastern University and Boston University are, the home of some of these... BUR is the NPR station, that's Boston University. Well, that's pretty closely tied to the mayor politically. And in fact, all the institutions are very dependent on the mayor for getting their building permits for expansion. So Northeastern, Harvard, all of the universities that have campuses in Boston are expanding madly because, you know, they take over land, they don't have to pay property tax, and everything is rezoned to what they want. Such a deal. So they can't afford to alienate him. So there's a conflict of interest there. I mean, I think that there's a real problem with that kind of a relationship when he has that power. He has complete power over all the development permitting through the Boston Redevelopment Authority, of course, his gloves.
Who is the mayor?
Tom Menino.
And how long has he been serving?
Well, he's in his fifth four-year term, so we're going to end up at 20 years unless he runs again, which is not out of the question. And he'd win. And I hope you don't ask me why he'd win, because I can't figure it out. But there you are, 20 years in office, in the cradle of democracy.
And you're writing at the South End News.
Right.
How did you become a journalist?
Well, I'm a landscape architect and urban designer by profession. And when I moved to Boston, I just started to see how projects were being reviewed and meeting people in neighborhoods and looking around to see what the development picture was. Because I don't do gardens, I do urban public works. And I just felt that I wanted to express an opinion about some of these things that were happening. Privatization of parks and other things that were happening. And it was all really very civilian. I pounded it out on my typewriter and sent it into the editor and hoped and prayed, and she liked it. And I got about a dozen published that way. Before the South End News actually asked me to write for them on a biweekly basis.
As you were expressing yourself politically, how is the landscape architecting profession that you were in trying to engage in? How was that impacted?
Oh, well, it wasn't impacted, but I was impacted. because of my writing and my advocacy and especially because of my interference in some demolitions of historic theaters in Boston, I really have been blacklisted professionally. I mean, no firm that I'd be interested in working in could hire me. The last one that dared found that they couldn't list me on staff lists for projects, you know, was sort of not going to work. So, but I feel like I've had a lot of influence on people in an educational way, because I've been to a million community meetings on development and planning in the city, and people who never used to talk about the Redevelopment Authority, who never even realized, you know, what it was, they just thought it was a city department. In the last mayoral race, there were three opponents, and each of the three challengers, ran on a platform that included eliminating the BRA. Which is unheard of, and it only took 15 years to get there. But that is such a deeply ingrained, you know, machine in the city that the idea that actual mayoral challengers would come out, and they actually were getting such great response. It started with one, and they saw how people were supportive of it, and so each of them hopped on the bandwagon. Yes, I will also get rid of the BRA. So I think that when I go to meetings, people now say things that they wouldn't have said before, like everybody knows you should not build a lot of parking. You know, they used to say, oh, we need more parking. And now they understand, don't build parking. It's not a good idea. Environmentally bad, all sorts of things. And zoning in Boston, you know, is a considered a guideline. I mean, people don't even know in Boston that zoning is law. You know, they just... So I kind of reminded people that those are actually laws. And you can insist that developers comply with them. And, well, people still feel like they'd be kind of sticklers if they demanded that. But at least they understand the concept, you know? And, of course, there are a few suits on wrongful variances, but that's a different thing. I'm talking about ignoring zoning in a sort of loophole way. Not in a way that gives legal recourse. I mean, that's the same all over the country. But the way the BRA has created zoning, they basically let all big developers just rezone themselves. They have various, I call them the five finagles, and they just kind of pick one that goes, you know, best with their project. And people have no legal recourse because it's part of the zoning code. It's loopholes that are built for this purpose.
Shirley Kressel, after the panel discussion, I had a chance to talk with you about the BRA, the Boston Redevelopment Authority, which you mentioned a bit. This is really fascinating. This is a body, as I'm, you know, learning from you, and if you could talk a bit more about it, it's not elected by the people of Boston, but that wields an enormous amount of influence over the major decisions that get made.
Well, it's an authority, which is not an unknown thing. Most cities and states have sundry authorities, and all over the country in the 50s, urban renewal authorities sprang up, the purpose of which was to carry out 40-year plans, basically, to jumpstart the post-war economy, you know, in the end of the World War II. And they were supposed to, you know, delineate areas of the city and tear down the so-called slums, which, of course, is where working people and black people lived, you know, the undesirables. And that was called slum clearance, to eliminate blight. Blight, a very useful term. Still a useful term, actually, for tax breaks. And then be gone. I mean, the redevelopment authorities were temporary. And the Boston Redevelopment Authority, the BRA, has made itself permanent in large part by hijacking the planning board. 3 years after the BRA was created, in 1960, they snuck into a piece of totally unrelated legislation, a paragraph that says, the planning board of Boston is hereby abolished and all its powers go to the BRA. It's unheard of. And there's no other city in America where that has happened. In fact, elsewhere, the urban renewal authorities are accountable to the planning boards, which in turn are accountable to elected city councilors or the equivalent thereof. And so there was always some kind of an elected accountability for the urban renewal, you know, machine, which is very devastating, you know, and it had to be overseen and controlled. People understood that, you know, very closely. Well, in Boston, it's just... It's sprung its tethers. It just escaped from all the surly bonds of law and has become a law unto itself. So it makes the plans for the city, except that it doesn't. There hasn't really been planning since they took over. That was the purpose of their taking over, so that planning wouldn't get in the way of their development agenda. They write the zoning. They advise the zoning commission. They advise the Board of Appeal. They are immune from legal recourse because courts don't meddle in local planning decisions. Courts will adjudicate wrongful variance suits, you know, if you go to a Board of Appeals. But they don't meddle when, you know, in the planning and in the creation of zoning. And those are basic sort of legislative functions of cities under city councils. Not in Boston. The city councilors were sent to their room with milk and cookies in 1960, and have been scratching their heads looking for a job ever since, because they don't have a say over any of the important things in the city. And the BRA also qualifies developers as blighted so they can get blight-based tax breaks. And the biggest of those, the City Council of Boston was excluded from a say in those awards. In other cities, the City Council, because it's a tax issue, the City Council has, and it's an urban renewal issue, so the City Council had a say. Well, in Boston, they wrote a legislation. In fact, the state code of Massachusetts is full of things that say except in Boston. I once did a Google search in the Mass Legislative website, except for Boston. And it's riddled and infested with laws that apply except for Boston. It's like a different legal precinct. And one of the major things they wanted to do in Boston is consolidate power, keep the city councilors, you know, knitting off in a corner. So the mayor and the BRA give those tax breaks. There's two of them that are blight-based. The other one, the city council has a voice in. And sadly, they always vote for it anyway, because they buy the story that every developer needs help and we have to make, you know, invest in job creation, the whole, you know, nonsense that Greg LeRoy debunked in his book, The Great American Job Scam. None of that is really true. So our city councilors have little to do and have had very little occasion to educate themselves on how to do what little they have left to do. So they're always getting tricked into signing off on things. And in 2004, they actually got tricked in signing away their rights over the BRA. They got tricked into signing away their rights over the BRA. I went to the state Urban Renewal Oversight Agency to say, well, what do you think? Can't you do something about this? And they said, well, we can only make sure that the locals get to do what they want to do. When the locals decide that they don't want to do anything, there's nothing we can do about it. So the city councilors, in a series of secret meetings, which I and two other citizens later sued on, when we found out about them, their secret, that was the point. But we didn't find out until it was too late, until the legislation came out. And then we said, well, when did all this happen? And then we found out they had a year and a half of secret meetings. And we're still in court on that. But they've confessed to everything. So our city council, instead of fighting to get its power back so we could have a real checks and balances, has been letting them, aiding and abetting the erosion of their own power. And I said to one of them one time, I said, don't you think the city council would want to have its normal involvement with planning and zoning like they do in other cities? And he actually said to me, he said, Shirley, do you realize what a mess it would be if we had to make all those decisions? And I said, yes, you have to earn your pay and take the heat from, you know, constituents. Yeah, that's why you're a city councilor. That would be the mess. This way they get their pay, they have very little to do, they make up their own projects, you know, they get interested in this thing or that thing, food trucks on the plaza, or, you know, odd little bits and odds and ends, and we don't have anybody actually doing planning in Boston.
As you're talking, I'm thinking about the Boston Redevelopment Authority and which branch of government it would fall under. Maybe executive if the mayor would appoint, but then you're saying you can't use the legislative body is not doing, legislative branch is not doing anything. The judicial branch doesn't appear to be able to do much, so it's an interesting body.
Very interesting, and you have absorbed exactly the right points about the BRA. It has deprived us of two of the three legs of democracy's three-legged stool. And it has entirely over-empowered the executive branch, who appoints the director and the board members. And it's a symbiotic relationship between them that was once described by the BRA director when he answered a city council question at a hearing. The city councilor, now it's amazing that a city council would have to ask this, but there you are. A city councilor actually asked, why was the BRA ever created? Remember, this is the body that's supposed to oversee the BRA and created the BRA. And this was an older city councilor, should have known. And the they're so arrogant, they don't have to be afraid of anything because, you know, they're not accountable to anybody. The director actually said, the BRA was created to do all the dirty things and throw the people off their land and keep the politicians' hands clean. And there hasn't been an eyelash batted about that, either when he said it or since, that he didn't even have to pretend, oh, we were created to remedy blight and we were created to make affordable housing, all the things that the papers say they were created for, you know, the mission statement. No, he just said it outright. We're the goon squad, and we make whatever the mayor wants to do happen, and we protect everybody from courtroom retribution and political retribution. This is the cradle of democracy.
Can you talk about the BRA's use of eminent domain?
Well, all the urban renewal agencies had the power of eminent domain. It was actually controversial and went through various court rulings, and the Supreme Court in 1954 ruled that economic development or revitalization or however they called it was a legitimate public purpose, and therefore they could use it as a justification for taking by eminent domain. So they all have eminent domain power, but it was assumed that it was power to take private land and compensate for it, because that's what eminent domain is, with just compensation. That's what the Constitution says. But in Boston, the BRA doesn't just take private land. Because what they did, they cleared it, you know, the slum clearance, and they sold it off to developers at fire sale prices and encouraged big, large-scale, you know, modern, new progress development. But in Boston, it's, I think, unique in the whole country that this happens. The BRA takes land from the city, from the taxpayers, from the city of Boston, by eminent domain, without compensation. And nobody gets it because they all think it's just one agency from the city, you know, transferring land to another agency of the city. But in fact, when the BRA takes city land, when they lease it out or sell it, they keep the money. It doesn't go into the city treasury. So all of that, hundreds of who knows how many billions of dollars worth of land, the BRA has confiscated with the mayor's blessing, with the mayor's instruction. Also, with the city council cut out of it. City council is supposed to have jurisdiction to oversee disposition of public land. Not in Boston. The mayor writes a letter, the BRA takes it, no money. The BRA sells it off, gets millions of dollars, and that's how the BRA is what they call self-funded. They call themselves, oh, we're self-funded. Like, they manufacture money out of air, you know? So they have like a $14 million budget, and they're always, whenever somebody says, well, we need to make a real city planning department, they always say, but you can't afford it. We do all your planning for free. And if you had to make a city planning department, you'd have to pay a staff, and it would just break you. And it's sort of like, you know, telling you can't afford your brain. And of course, the joke is that the BRA costs us, you know, 10 times, 100 times more than a planning department would. And then we end up, of course, with what the BRA wants, which is urban renewal. And that's been discredited for a long time. So you take a historic city that's the cradle of democracy, you take away the public's voice, you rebuild it as a, you know, sort of faceless outpost of, I didn't even want to insult any cities, but, you know, placeless glass towers. And they keep the money, and nobody understands it. Nobody understands it. Even newspaper reporters, when I go to them with this story, they say, well, what's the big deal? It's like one department transferring it to another. And I said, well, the big deal is the city doesn't get the money for its property. Then we cut the budget for the schools and the firefighters and the police because we don't have any money. The libraries, because we're short. Why are we short? Because the mayor gives away hundreds of millions of dollars to feed the BRA under the table so that they don't have to come before the city council to get a budget approval. That's how they figured out to avoid the last shred of accountability. is to get their money without city council approval in the budget.
And for the city council members, who is the council in City Hall Plaza?
They're in City Hall, which is on City Hall Plaza.
Can you talk about City Hall Plaza? I mean, this is not happening, you know, in far-flung places from them. In fact, City Hall Plaza is one of the properties
where they sit. Right, right. When they look out the window, they look at City Hall Plaza. And what they see is a place that used to belong to the city of Boston and the taxpayers of Boston. And it was that was an urban renewal area. It used to be all little brick houses and shops and, you know, places that we would love and cherish today, but in urban renewal it was called a slum and they threw it away. And this plaza was a part of the urban renewal plan that the BRA had taken all that land, all that private property, and the the justification for all that eminent domain, which was all publicly paid for. The compensation is all paid by taxpayers. So again, the BRA has no money of its own. It's just a big pass-through, except that it catches a lot of stuff in the middle. So that plaza was a condition of their taking of all that land from private owners, to whom they paid compensation, wretched as it was, you know, and inadequate, but still, you know, legally. In 1996, the Boston Redevelopment Authority entered a joint venture partnership with a bunch of developers, downtown developers, that called themselves, of course, what else? The Trust for City Hall Plaza. And the BRA, which is a government agency, I mean, it's a quasi-public, but it's still, you know, the powers of the public, became a joint venture partner, a co-developer with these private developers. And they made a plan to build a hotel and a huge garage on a part of the land of City Hall Plaza. And they did the usual thing. Oh, the city can't afford to take care of the plaza, so if we build this hotel and garage, it'll spin off the $25 million a year we need to clean the rest of the plaza, which is silly because the whole thing is brick. The cleaning bill must be, you know, nominal. Well, as it turns out, they never did get to do that. They never did get to build it. But the mayor had instructed the BRA, I have a copy of the letter, to take City Hall Plaza by eminent domain. And I actually got the councilors riled up enough to have a hearing. Because they finally, you know, figured out, wait a minute, this doesn't seem right. So they had a hearing with the BRA. And they said, well, how could you take it by eminent domain? I mean, you can only take stuff that's blighted. And they said, well, we think that the urban renewal plan hasn't worked out. And we think it's blighted again, and it needs another urban renewal plan. Yeah, their own. And of course, the city council doesn't know how to handle the BRA and doesn't know their rights with the BRA. At the time, they still had a little rights over the BRA. Now, as I told you, they've pretty much signed it away. So they have these hearings. They don't understand what's being said to them by the BRA. They wordsmith it around the BRA so that nobody really knows what to answer back, even. And, you know, now when they look out, the City Hall Plaza is no longer City Hall Plaza, really. It's a redevelopment parcel owned by the BRA. And when they get around to it, in fact, the BRA recently proposed that City Hall be demolished and the functions of City Hall be moved to the waterfront here where we're sitting. Do you see how far away this is from Government Center? How far away is from the subways? How hard it is for citizens to get to? This is where they wanted to make the mayor and City Hall functions, out here, in nowhere.
An agency of the government has the capacity to move the government. It seems like, you know...
Well, they're not even an agency of this government,
right,
strictly speaking. So everybody was asking me, well, what do you think? Would City Hall be better on the seaport? And I said, do you not understand that this is the BRA trying finally to wring the profits out of City Hall Plaza? Because they'd get the land under City Hall, right? They do it before anybody even realized that it hadn't been taken originally. They hadn't taken by eminent domain the land right under the building. So before anybody could even understand what was happening, they would own another couple of acres of land and have cleared themselves an even bigger chunk of downtown Boston, the primest location, right near the historic commercial crossroads, near the crossing of all the transit lines, near the State House, near the federal buildings. Think of all the lawyers and lobbyists that would love to have an office there. So it's something like $400 million worth of land as a BRA parcel. And the councilors even know that. They've even said that. And here, all of the media, in fact, nobody knew that. None of the reporters knew that. They were all talking about how the city would sell the plaza and, use the money to build a new city hall. And I kept having to tell people, the city can't sell the plaza. The city doesn't own the plaza. The BRA owns the plaza. It does not belong, $400 million out of the taxpayers' pockets. Nobody was watching when that happened. All on the quiet. So, the media can't even be a watchdog because the way the BRA has set themselves up is so complicated that only somebody as, dogged and foolish and, unaccepting of all of this as me will go and learn and immerse myself and figure it all out and see what they're really doing. So that's why I formed that Alliance of Boston Neighborhoods to try to, so that we could all share information and realize, what the BRA is doing with the city. Because everybody thinks it's their project and their neighborhood and their, something bad is happening. They don't understand. It's the whole system. That's how it all works. They think we don't have a voice. We have to make the BRA listen to us. No, you can't make the BRA listen to you. They don't have to, and they never will. And people do not get it. They say, well, maybe we could improve them. Maybe we could make them more sensitive to public. No. They're constructed to not be improved. If they wanted to be improved, they'd be a city department. And you could vote for, city councilors and make it better. This way they have made themselves a law unto themselves. And if you don't get rid of them, you're never going to have a voice in what happens to the community. Even if you think you won at one meeting, the next time you come back and they'll be doing what they wanted to do.
I wanted to finish, since this is the National Conference for Media Reform here in Boston, you've already touched on it, but maybe just a little bit more on the media. Here you are, kind of an end round way of becoming a journalist, and the question you asked is, why am I raising these issues, and where are the other journalists who have newsrooms and staff and access to this information? And you're raising these issues. Where are the other journalists today?
Well, I've asked that question a lot, and maybe part of it is that the budgets have been cut, and they don't have as much resources to put into investigative reporting. But I can't help but feel that that in places where there really is a concentrated political power, that it affects the media. And not only political power, but economic power. I know a newspaper that was closed down because all the advertisers withdrew. It was one of those small local papers. And that publisher... It was really a mom-and-pop newspaper. It was actually just a mom newspaper. And she was printing my pieces about that City Hall Plaza business, actually. And I've actually heard when I print in papers that they get calls from the mayor's office sometimes. Don't you think that your paper is taking on a decidedly negative tone, they'll say? And, that's a threat. So papers have to decide to print my stuff, And, just by definition, that's a problem. I'm not a I'm not so much an opinion writer. I mean, I'm a fact exposer. And I would frankly be thrilled if they did it themselves and not me, because it's a huge expenditure of my time. I don't get paid for it. And all the time, reporters are calling me up and asking me questions, and I have to, like, start from the beginning with how City Hall Plaza got taken and, you know, why it's not a city agency. And I'm annoyed, because why do I have to spend time, you know, teaching generations of reporters basic facts like that? Maybe they don't have time. They're not paid to do that kind of, you know, somebody said in there, you know, we can't spend 5 weeks digging up a story. That doesn't, you know, it's seldom that an editor can have the luxury to send them off and do that. Part of it is this feeling that, you know, they have to live to print another day, and they can't, you know, infuriate everybody that they're going to have to call the next time for a story. You know, politicians are notoriously vengeful. So I don't have an answer for that, but it certainly is an argument for more citizen journalism.
Thanks, Shirley Kressel. You're certainly an example of citizen journalism. It's been a pleasure meeting you.
Thanks. Nice to meet you.